public part of the proceedings, obviously, that's what we should have been looking forward to, a long discussion with our invited guests. I will introduce them as they're sitting at the far end. A familiar face to you as all, Eamon Molly, the journalist. Also, Dr. Stephen Baker, who we've already heard from, and Stephen's obviously agreed to also sit in the panel. Also, Dr. Aaron Edwards, a long-time friend of the party, I'd say, in an hour quite away. Professor John Brewer. Thank you, John, for coming. Also, Dr. Chris Hudson, again, a long-time...
Reverend.
Yeah. Sorry.
But you can give me a doctorate if you want to.
Ian Paisley.
Actually, the defender party leader, he actually said, was it Reverend something?
Oh, he's a Reverend as well.
I don't believe that.
It's a Reverend.
Then, of course, Councillor Billy Hutchinger, party leader. So, just the context of what I'm going to hand over to Stephen in a second, but I mean, the context that we're discussing here, that's going to take. Going to do today is, and the legacy of the 1984 Northern Ceasefire, the challenges encountered, and the impact both positively and negatively arising out of that time, and also then later probably looking ahead to future challenges and the opportunities that lie ahead. So that's the context of it, and I'll hand over to Stephen. Thank you.
Cheers, thanks, Brian. Okay, what we'll do is I'm going to ask the guests on the panel maybe to sort of talk a little bit first of all, by asking them some questions, and then we'll throw it open to the floor. I'm sure you have things that you'll want to ask people, and we'll proceed that way there. I suppose the obvious place to start really is with Billy down the end of the table there. And one of the things that I'd be interested to hear myself is, what do you think made the ceasefires possible? Because I'm sure there's a lot of hard work on in the background to get to that kind of a stage.
Yeah, well, I think William Smith had alluded to some of it, but obviously in the short bit it wasn't. But I mean, if I can just give you a sort of very quick history about it, I mean, I think it, in the mid-80s, they were trying to get rid of, the government at the time were trying to get rid of two things. One was Lochcash, and the second was the tower block, which they hadn't finished in terms of City Hospital, because both were costing a fortune. And at that particular time, we'd been involved in discussions within Lochcash, and they'd been bringing all sorts of people in to talk to us, and an Australian diplomat came to meet me and a couple of other people, and he was having dinner in Whitehall that night, and he told people in Whitehall that they needed to come back and talk to me because they felt that there was something in what I was saying that was happening outside. So that led very quickly to the UVF and the PUP on the outside actually looking at what could be done. It also led to talks with the Provisional IRA, and Jim McDonald, who is now was party organiser in the PUP and one of the founder members, died a few years ago. But Jim told me the story when he came to see me in Lochcash. He went in a revolving door in Europa, and as he was getting into the provost were coming out the other side, because obviously he knew who it was. So the government had opened up talks very early on in the mid-80s with paramilitary organisations, and I think that was the sense of that something needed to happen. So the organisations at that particular time have been looking how they would actually achieve that, and I think that's very important to understand. But for me, the significance was in 1991, whenever the Loyalists called a ceasefire, most people think that that ceasefire collapsed because the IRA started bombing working class housing estates. It wasn't. It was a combination of it, but I think the straw that broke a camel's back was that the constitutional parties that they were called at that particular time couldn't get agreement. If you remember, and they tried to get that agreement and couldn't get it. So from that time on, I think that people then decided that they would have to talk to others, as Blumsmith has said, but that also that the PUP and the UDP, which was formed around about that time, would need to actually be ready for any ceasefires that would come, and it took another 3 years. So it was hard work. There was a number of things that happened, and people were working with conflict resolutionists from different parts of the world. And that whole idea was that people would go out and sell that, but the UVF from that stage on knew that they would have to find some sort of solution, but they'd have to find a solution that would actually mean that the union was safe, and I think we've got there with that, but unfortunately it hasn't been recognised either in the media or in academia, I think that this loyalist story hasn't really been told, and I think that from our point of view, that would be one of the challenges that we need to get it told.
We'll pick up on that again later on. Eamon, I just want to come to you because obviously once the ceasefires are called, you're a local journalist with a job reporting it. What do you recall of the kind of reaction amongst the press to the ceasefire?
Thank you for inviting me here today, guys. And I have strong views. I'm at a stage in my life and I don't care who knows my views. I'm not going to be less well off, better off as a result of what I say. But I say things, popular or unpopular, if I believe them. I think it would be appropriate. I was there the day that the loyalist ceasefire was actually called, and I was just reflecting, and I was looking at a photograph there the last few days of the people at the top table. Many of those people aren't with us today. Gone. I think it would be appropriate to pause for a moment to reflect on people like Jim McDonald, mentioned by Billy there, and Gusty and guys like that, because we're only here for a while. It just goes to show you, those guys are gone. They made a contribution, and I don't think we should forget the matter. It was an interesting time, because we shouldn't forget this. Mainstream unionists vehemently opposed the ceasefires. Jim Molyneux said that the IRA ceasefire was the most destabilizing event in history in terms of unionism. I was so offended by that remark. I was so offended by that remark that anybody should oppose the ending of any manifestation of violence. As a consummate pacifist, I was offended. And I haven't ever been against talking to people of a paramilitary persuasion. Billy knows this. I was probably the first journalist in Belfast ever to say publicly that unless the governments became involved directly in talking to organisations with a political motivation and all that, there wouldn't be a resolution of our problem. We were at a community relations committee, a meeting in Malone House, and I made this point on a platform along with another academic, and Billy was there, and Billy stood up and said, "This is the first time I've heard this coming across the floor." And you recall that, Billy?
Yeah.
So I have never been opposed. And I also hold to the view that instead of sending bombs across the world from America and Britain, that they should start talking to ISIS or ISIL. Call it what you like. They will bomb all those people out of existence in a million years, and they'll have to talk to them about them. So that's my position on that. In terms of the aftermath of the ceasefire, I do find it offensive that those who oppose the ceasefires, your ceasefire, the IRA ceasefire, are now part of an industry around the world, right from the midst, from our midst, telling the world how we won, how they won the peace in Northern Ireland. They opposed the peace in Northern Ireland. Some of those people now are appointing rapporteurs in the Democratic Unionist Party to get your vote in East Belfast, to capture East Belfast for the Democratic Unionist Party in the next election. So we saw how they behaved when the ceasefires happened, and we see what's going on today in terms of how mainstream unionism is seeking to exploit you as people from a working class area at this moment in time so that they can regain power in East Belfast for the Democratic Unionist Party. Secondly, in a very contemporary way, it baffles me to think why you, as representatives of working class people in Protestant areas, would support the implementation of the Conservative Tory welfare reform. Because the pain that's going to be felt at Turf Lodge, New Lodge, various areas of nationalist community would be visited upon your community correspondingly, working class poor areas. And I want to make this general observation about how I see loyalism, and particularly working class loyalism, the Progressive Unions Party today. It does hurt me a bit, because I was a civil rights activist in the sense I was at the first civil rights march in Uri. I wrestled with a guy who was a contemporary of mine at school who had a leg of a chair up his coat at a civil rights march. That's not the way we were brought up by my parents when it came to civil rights. It was peaceful, peaceful, peaceful. Now, if I hadn't had the parents that I had, I might have been an intelligence officer in the IRA in South Armagh. That's why I am never judgmental by people with a background like yours, because in different circumstances, many of the people here lay in jail for many years. In different circumstances, I too could have been in jail. Now, so I'm not going to be judgmental about people's past. I am judgmental about people's future and where you are bringing your community and where you're not bringing your community and what's going on in your community and the abuses within your own communities and the abuses tolerated by your leadership within your community. Those issues are issues about which I will be judgmental and to which I will draw attention. But basically, there's goodness in all of us. We have to mine that goodness and develop it. And I would say, and I've said this to Billy, and I've written it, I know there's a lot of energy being expended at Tweddell, but I've said this to Billy in writing. If you channeled as much energy, and I disagree with what Brian said, your vice chair, where he said issues raised by Stephen Baker, and I agree with nearly everything Stephen Baker said. I think it's nonsense, this $80 million spent on the G8 and all. Absolute nonsense. And if anybody here would even probe this film industry, this phony, farcical film industry, of which we're boasting and which has been promoted at a huge expense, just check how many local people. Do you know that they bring the coffee in from London? Our coffee's not good enough for these guys during this filmmaking in Northern Ireland. Not even our coffee is good enough. Now, Espresso Elements on the Lisbon Road does me fine. Nero's does me fine. These guys have the coffee flowing in from London. Where do they go at the weekends? They want out of here on Thursday, these guys. Where do they go? Dublin, London. Our place, this place isn't good enough for these guys. How many local people are actually involved? I'm giving this information from inside that industry, from one guy who works in there, who knows exactly what's going on in there. So we want to be very honest with ourselves. Finally, our politicians, the behaviour, I think, is mocking this perceived economic growth that's taking place. Their behaviour is mocking our demands as people, our economic demands. I'll just conclude. If you as a party mobilised around the following civil rights, better infrastructure within your areas, better education for your people, better opportunities. I ask the question, how many graduates are coming out of the Shankill Road? How many graduates are coming out of Tigers Bay? These are issues around which you will mobilise public opinion. You will get people from the Catholic nationalist community. You will get those people marching with you. You won't get people marching with you about Tweddell. But opportunities for young people, the males, the young males in your community, you know the situation. What's going on? Why don't we hear about that every day? We hear about flags every day. Why do we not hear about the young people who are not getting an opportunity in your communities? Thank you very much.
Okay, Chris, unfortunately it's up to you to follow that. I'm really just with a question about it. I mean, and you've got a congregation, and I'm wondering if you could reflect a little bit upon what the response was of people on the ground to the announcement of the Loyalist ceasefires.
Without labouring the point, I thoroughly agree with Eamon and yourself regarding the whole thing about social issues. But I think we'll take that as a given, you know, that's what the PUP is about, first and foremost, is a party that cares about social issues and how they relate to people and organising around that. I would agree with Eamon as well that the coffee and espresso elements on the Lisburn Road is the best coffee I've ever tasted. I fundamentally disagree with him that he should denigrate anyone for going to Dublin for a weekend.
I'll buy that.
Without any prejudice, there is nowhere like Dublin. And that's without any prejudice. But however, going back to the Loyalist ceasefire, I remember when we were working close up to the Loyalist ceasefire, and what impressed me was particularly people like David and one or two other people that it would be unfair to mention their names, who I always regard them as the architects of what happened around the Loyalist ceasefire. And there weren't too many people out there that believed that the CLMC could actually pull off a ceasefire. And that was because the narrative that was accepted at the time, and I don't mind mentioning names, by people like Tim Pat Coogan, for instance, by people like Neil McCafferty. Neil McCafferty actually said to me, to my face in Dublin, these people are incapable of ever any level of sophisticated thinking or getting together, or act together to call a ceasefire. The only thing they're ever good at is murdering the occasional Catholic. And at this time, she wouldn't have been aware that I was engaged with people like David and other people. And that informally having discussions through myself with Dick Spring, who was the tarnished Deputy Prime Minister and Minister for Foreign Affairs, and an excellent political assistant, Fergus Finlay, who was Dick Spring's political officer. And those discussions were around the issue of convincing the Dublin government that a loyalist ceasefire would be predicated on the issue of the union was safe. And the fear that maybe in the discussions that with the London government that people could be pushing at an open door and they may concede more than was necessary. So for Dublin, ironically, for Dublin to have a little bit of a hold on what was conceded to nationalism within Northern Ireland. And the Dublin government were very supportive of that idea, because what they wanted out of this was a ceasefire in Northern Ireland, a political dispensation, which was fair to both communities here. On the 13th of October 1994, we all know that was the date that the Loyalist ceasefire was called. And I think people, particularly in the South, not people like Finlay, not people like Dick Spring, people were taken aback. Except Albert Reynolds, because Albert, as people know, was in communication with Roy McGee. And Roy was Reverend Roy McGee, an excellent man, excellent man. And Albert was a risk taker. And, you know, and sometimes, Billy, you were talking about, you know, loyalists being written out of the narrative. To some extent, Albert has been written out of the narrative, which is unfair to Albert Reynolds. And, you know, there's an old saying, Brendan Behan once said that when you consider all the people who claim they fought the Black and Tans, well, the Black and Tans must have been the bravest little body of men that ever existed. And that the GPO must have been a 20-floor building in 1916 to cater for all. And I have never met so many people of late who actually brought around the Loyalist ceasefire. They're queuing up to claim it. They're queuing up reverend gentlemen, politicians, people that, as Eamon quite rightly pointed, had no vested interest in bringing around peace at that time. And it was to the courage of people like David Irvine and Billy and others. And as David said to me, there is nothing, Chris, that I say to you or take to the Dublin government that I don't say to the average volunteer in the UVF. I don't have one story for them and one story for the people in the UVF. It's the same line that I have for each other. So when the ceasefire was called, and I think what did touch people in the South was Gusty's remarks around the issue of true remorse and regret for all the innocent people that died. I think that did connect with people. The other thing is when the Republican ceasefire broke down in 96, and that to the greater extent, not completely, but to the greater extent, loyalism held the ceasefire. I think that impressed people. And it showed a level of sophistication. Now, we always have to bear in mind that there were hundreds and thousands of victims of the conflict here, and we never for one moment should park them. They're always at the back of our minds and in our hearts when we're talking about this. But at the same time, we've got to remember the level of sophistication that existed within loyalism at that time. I remember at one stage, it hasn't been written about yet, but David, and I'll just call him the craftsman, asked me to try and get the Irish government to make a comment around late 96. I know I have the date somewhere. And it was when John Bruton, who was Taoiseach, and John Bruton was going to address the joint houses in Washington. And I got him to put in a paragraph, more or less reaffirming the same thing that Brooke had said regarding we have no selfish economic reason over Northern Ireland other than for a peaceful outcome. And John Bruton put that into his statement. And he was slagged off the next day in Dáil Éireann by Bertie Ahern, because Bertie Ahern said it contravened Articles 2 and 3. But that was put in so that loyalism would hear it and know that there was still the South, where there were no secret deals, and that the Irish government was committed to this process. That's the type of sophisticated thinking that was around at that time. So for other people to describe those who were acting on behalf of loyalism as Neanderthal, as incapable of that level of sophisticated thinking, was absolute nonsense. And the danger of it was, that could have been missed. Because certain voices were saying, you can't engage with loyalism. There is no political process there. That could have been missed. But fortunately it wasn't, because people did engage. And because people like David and Billy made sure that engagement took place. And we got the loyalist ceasefire. And we got the sustained truce or ceasefire when the IRA, after Canary Wharf. And I think, I remember David coming down to Dublin one time. It was 2 weeks after the law, and I'll finish on this. It was 2 weeks after the loyalist ceasefire. And the Dublin Council of Trade Unions invited David down to address them. And the place was bunged. You couldn't get in. It was packed to the rafters. And David was a bit nervous about speaking, because he said, this is kind of enemy territory for me. And he got up and he spoke from the heart, and he got a standing ovation. And someone said to him afterwards, Jesus, David, you could nearly stand for Fianna Fáil in the morning and win at EC. And that was because, and I would say it to people here, as a Dublin man, I often think loyalism misinterprets what people in the South think. The South was never, never just safe territory for the Provost or for the IRA. You should always remember that members of the Gardaí and members of the Irish Security Forces died at the hands of the IRA. We all know about Garda McCabe from Limerick. And sometimes within loyalism, that's missed. That there is people you can engage with. And I think out of today, I would like people to consider this. I would ask people to consider going beyond your own comfort zone. And Eamon touched upon this, like the flag issue and other issues. I know they're important. I know how emotional they can be. As a taxi driver said to me, well, he said, you know, the tricolour flies on the GPO 365 days a year. And if anyone tried to take it down, I would be outside the GPO to put it back up. So I understand the emotion and the attachment to people's national flag and so forth. But just to sometimes step outside that comfort zone and engage with other people, because you will find there are thousands upon thousands willing to engage with loyalism, working class loyalism, people who were at one time the backbone of the old Northern Ireland Labour Party. I'm talking about engaging with the trade union movement. I'm talking about engaging with people in the Republic. I'm talking about engaging with people on that other part of the Union, Great Britain, engaging with more people there to build allies, to build your thinking, develop your supporters, to develop common bonds and solidarity with other people. And I'll definitely finish on this now. One of the things we learned from the Scottish referendum, and it was one of the things from the Scottish nationalists, I think, which was a positive thing, was they never talked only about cultural nationalism. There was great talk about civic nationalism. And I think loyalism can take the lead on that, and not only talk in terms of cultural unionism, in that to be a unionist, you have to be Protestant, you have to be in the Orange Order. I personally believe you can vote for the union and play GAA, and even, as Linda knows, Lauren and the Cúpla Focal speak a couple of words of Irish. And I think you've got to consider that. And you've got to consider the possibility of civic unionism. Unionism that is beyond just cultural identity. Today, and I had a funeral this morning, that's why I was late here. And one of the family was telling me, and I mentioned it in the funeral service, her son is a young soldier. A young soldier who was given the military cross in Afghanistan for saving the life of a young Afghani soldier who was wounded. He ran out under fire, gathered up that young Afghani soldier and brought him back, and was granted the military cross by Her Majesty for doing that. Now, I would hate to think if that young Afghani came to live in Northern Ireland, having been rescued by a young soldier from Northern Ireland, that someone would want to throw him out or burn him out. And I leave you with that. Thank you.
Beside me, I've got two academic colleagues, John Brewer and Aaron Edwards, an historian and a sociologist. Aaron, I'll come to you first for some sort of sense of the historical significance, perhaps, of the ceasefires.
Right. Well, I'll step out of my role as a historian and begin with an anecdote. The first time I encountered, given that William Mitchell has shared his story about Billy Mitchell, I'll share mine. The first time I encountered him was at a corner gable end in Rathcoole. He was given an oration and Remembrance Day on behalf of fallen volunteers, but he had essentially given the first draft of something that later went into the Principles of Loyalism. Next time I saw him, he thrust a copy, an early draft, 2001, of the Principles of Loyalism into my hands and said, "What do you think of that?" At that stage, of course, I'd only met him for the first time. My face had screwed up, and it had screwed up because he had offered me a cup of tea with milk that was off. I've since found out that that's actually how it used to be served in Loncash, and he didn't know any difference, but I certainly did. But getting over that initial shock, I was very impressed with what I read. And I think that I start with that anecdote because Billy wasn't just someone who talked about this. He lived it, and he brought people along with him, and I was very proud and privileged to have been involved with Billy Mitchell in conflict transformation work that he had undertaken and was very well known for. And he recognised the potential in people, and I think that that's one of the things that I would like to begin by talking about, and I'll keep this brief, but I think that there is potential within the wider working class Protestant community, and it's about harnessing that potential. I mean, certainly I have been very privileged in the sense that the people that I knew, that I grew up knowing, were the people who have entered into history books, not to a similar degree as the likes of the Republican leadership, but certainly they are more than a footnote, and hopefully those who are interested in giving an alternative narrative would be open to that. And I'm certainly open to that because of my own background. I grew up in Rathcoole. I didn't pass the 11+. I wasn't meant to be an academic. I was meant to work in shorts, but as one of my cousins is finding out at the minute, overseeing payoffs, there was no guaranteed job there either, so I ended up being an academic, or as some of my friends have pointed out, still not knowing what I want to do in life. But what I would say is that my perception of things is skewed by that, and that's why the first time attending PUP conferences in over 12 years that I found it difficult to talk in front of all of you. Usually I'm at the back taking notes, and doing my low profile, The World of Good. But I think that there is a view that historians, like any other academics, should be objective. I can't be objective. I can't be objective because I have baggage too, because I grew up in a working class Protestant community, and therefore I'm perceived, not by people in this room, thankfully, I'm amongst friends, but out there amongst academic colleagues as something of an oddity. An oddity in the sense that I'm not prepared to stand up and condone actions. That was never the plan. That was never the remit given to me by Billy Mitchell all those years ago, over 10 years ago, to become a critical friend, and it's certainly not the role that I'm here to perform today. But I would say that there are difficulties with those who do overly criticise loyalism, and because they just don't get it. I don't think they really read books, and they certainly don't talk to anybody. And that's a major problem. I mean, what I've seen, for example, I'll take a year, 1993, there was a killing of a man, John Gibson, in Carnmoney. And that was not the first death that affected me by the Troubles, but this man had no, he was not a combatant, he was simply a director of Henry Brothers. But what is missed, I mean, the thing that's always got me thinking about this period is, well, why did this man meet his end in the evening he came home from work? Why was he murdered by the Provisional IRA when he was not a combatant? Well, they'd opened up this idea of a legitimate target, and I think that over the next few weeks, you saw the Shankill bombing, the atrocity in the Shankill, and other atrocities were perpetrated, this tit-for-tat cycle. That happened. I experienced it. I felt what it was like in some of the places where these attacks were taking place. It was electric. The atmosphere was electric. But as a historian looking back on that, I have to try and explain it a bit more impartially if I can't be objective. And I think that I take a similar approach to the likes of the Loyalist ceasefire. You know, everybody talks about where they were. Certainly my mother knows where she was when President Kennedy was shot on the 22nd of November 1963. I was in on the 13th of October 1994 standing in a betting shop just outside Rathkill Estate with my grandfather. And I remember people talking about this thing. And I remember, and that was in the afternoon, I remember people talking about these events because they affected them, because they were involved in one way or another. And what I'm trying to get at, I suppose, is that it's really incumbent upon me as a historian and somebody from that background to stand up and say people did experience this in the wider community, and that's hopefully what I've been doing over the years and will continue to do. I was given an opportunity to write about this in The Other View by Billy Mitchell, and I worked for The Other View for a couple of years. Really worthwhile project where those dialogues were happening, where an exchange between loyalism and republicanism was taking place. And I met all sorts of people, courtesy of The Other View and through Billy Mitchell. And it amazed me how those people were open and private to the contribution that loyalism was making to the peace process. But in public, they were not. And I have a real difficulty. I can write about this until I'm blue in the face, but that doesn't mean that anybody will read it, and that certainly doesn't mean to say that anybody will agree with it. And I think that that's what's happened with Tony Novosel's book. Because it's making a dent in the myth, then it's unacceptable. And it's unacceptable to a wider audience because it's been deemed unacceptable because it's telling a positive story about loyalism. And that's the sort of environment in which people like me apply our trade and trying to get this message out, but continually being shot down, not literally, thankfully, but and told that this is irrelevant or you're simply just an apologist. And that's not good enough. If you go out to the wider world, there is a story to be told about here, but in Northern Ireland, for some unknown reason, people are not prepared to hear that. I think that there is a story to be heard beyond the platitudes that are dealt by those statesmen, usually statesmen, occasional stateswomen on the world stage. And I would agree wholeheartedly with what Eamon Malley has said in trying to get that, trying to acknowledge that, get some sort of acknowledgement about the contributions that loyalism has made. Now, looking ahead to the future, you'll be glad to hear I'll be finished in a minute. What are the challenges and opportunities? I think that there has been no articulation of what unionism is all about. There is this view, and I talk many, many times with people over the years about this, that you didn't need to do anything to maintain the union. That you simply, the union was a fact, it was an empirical fact, to use an academic term. It was there, it was tangible. Well, you know, that's no longer the case. A maintenance of the union in a polity like the United Kingdom in transition is something that needs to be done. It's not being done by mainstream unionism. It's not being done. I'm here not as a historian primarily, I'm here as a concerned UK citizen, not the concerned residents, but I'm a UK citizen. I live in England now. You are denied the rights that I have over there. Denied them because you're completely out of step with the rest of the UK. And you're out of step by a party and by parties that use the term unionism, and they're nothing of the sort. They're little Ulster parties. They're completely out of step, always have been, always will be. They want what they want and forget everybody else. And there is certainly a strata in society, to borrow a term that your man to the right of me might have used or might not have as media studies lectures, but there is a mainstream unionism. Used to be referred to as the Fur Coat Brigade, but fur coat's looking a bit threadbare these days. Certainly those people who stand up and tell the rest of the world what they think, and never ever let people, working class people, find a voice. And I'm just here, as I say, as a concerned citizen to speak up for those people who don't have a voice, and I welcome any questions that you have.
John, at the end there, have you some reflections on this?
Well, I have, and I've written on the ceasefire. And as an academic, I would be prepared to say that the Loyalist ceasefire was exceedingly and exceptionally important. But what I'd like to do is to set that ceasefire in a set of special circumstances that I think pertained then. And what I'd like to do is to challenge you to consider whether those circumstances exist today, and if they do or they don't, what's the responsibility of the Progressive Unionist Party to re-establish them. And I'm going to be brief. One of the things that made loyalism special in those days was that it was united. There was an organisational framework that provided a unity within loyalism around the combined loyalist military command. You knew who to dialogue with. You knew who to engage with via back channel communications. Roy McGee and all those others knew whom to engage with. Now, it has to be said, loyalism is now as divided as it was before the ceasefires. Now, I think there was a moral framework of reconciliation then. A moral framework of reconciliation that was given to loyalism by the Christian socialist ethos of people like Billy Mitchell and Gusty Spence. But there was also a class framework. Under David, there was an emphasis upon grassroots politics. And I also be prepared to say that actually I think there was a cultural framework in 93. Because quite frankly, the rest of society had much higher expectations then than we do now. Much higher expectations. There was a greater sense of hope, a greater sense of peace, and a greater sense of reconciliation, of progress, And I keep emphasising that because you're the Progressive Unionist Party. There's a greater, there was a cultural framework of hope and expectation that I think, well, I won't say that. And I think also there was a political framework. Because for the first time in 93, loyalists were incorporated into a political dialogue. Now, it's true that Protestant churchmen were dialoguing with loyalists, providing access to Albert Reynolds, providing access to John Major. One of them sitting beside me, but there's Roy McGee, there's Robin Eames. Now, you know as well as I do that most Protestant churchmen at that time were more likely to be dialoguing with Republicans than they were with Loyalists. I mean, I was recently in Fitzroy Presbyterian Church, Ken Newell's old church, giving a talk about a book I'd just written on ex-combatants. And I said to them, I posed a challenge to that church was more likely to hug a Catholic than they were to hug a Loyalist. And but that was different in 93, because there was a greater sense of incorporation of loyalists. Now, those factors were special then. They gave loyalists a huge contribution via the ceasefire. Now, I pose those to you today. What about the divisions within loyalism? What about the decline in the moral framework of reconciliation that I think has perhaps disappeared, sadly, with the death of Billy and Gusty? Are you focused enough on class politics? Now, forgive me, and I don't want to be offensive, forgive me, but I was recently interviewed by the BBC, and I said what loyalism needed was a Protestant Sinn Féin. Now, what I meant by that was that you want a party that can deal with national issues, but at the same time get your drains sorted out and deal with flooding. So are we pushing grassroots politics? How are we responding to the level of disappointment, disillusion with the peace process? Because there is huge disillusion and disappointment. We've got not just low expectations, we've got no expectations. So somebody says, I'm not going to turn up to the beginning of talks that represent my hope that we will have a solution here, because it's going to be a circus. Now, who, I ask you, is the clown when they refuse to meet my hopes for talks about the resolution and a better future? And are loyalists now incorporated into the political framework? So those are challenges that I think made the situation in the ceasefires very, very special, and I'm not quite sure that they're represented today. Now, I'd like to go on to talk a little bit about what I call the sociology of loyalism, but I'll shut up.
Maybe get a question.
Thank you very much to all the panellists there. I mean, there's some